A Massachusetts judge has vacated the first-degree murder conviction of former New England Patriots player Aaron Hernandez. He was convicted in the 2013 murder of Odin Lloyd. Hernandez was found hanged in his prison cell last month, and his death was ruled a suicide, leading to today's news that Superior Court Judge Susan Garsh has overturned Hernandez's conviction. Joining us now to discuss this and other legal news is retired Massachusetts federal judge and WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner. Judge Gertner, good to see you again.
Good to be here.
It's been too long. Well, let's begin with this ruling in or this vacating of Hernandez's first degree murder conviction. Judge Garsh said the courts basically had no choice. Here she is describing the decision.
The court has no choice but to abate the proceedings ab initio by vacating Hernandez's convictions and dismissing the charges against him and his appeal.
Ab initio. What is that?
Well, it is a 19th century legal doctrine that says that essentially with the death of the defendant, the proceedings go back to a point where as if there had been no charges, abatement from the beginning. Ab initio is from the beginning. And it really is half the states still have this doctrine in full bore with no exceptions. Some states have tried to moderate it. It was the doctrine that led to the setting aside of the conviction of John Salvey,
right,
who was the person convicted of shootings at an abortion clinic. It led to setting aside the conviction of Ken Lay, who was involved
Enron.
In Enron. Right. So
he died, 3 months before he was supposed to be sentenced.
Right. Yeah. And the Salvey was a suicide. Enron was a heart attack.
Also John Gagan.
That's right.
The former Catholic priest who was convicted of, obviously, of child sex abuse.
Right. And so it for this to change, it would have to be, it's not a change that a superior court judge can do on her own. So Judge Garsh is completely within her role. It's something that the Supreme Judicial Court could do, but is not likely to do in this case. It could do going forward, but not likely to do in this case.
Now, is this separate from the legal tradition in Massachusetts of also providing an automatic appeal for those people who have been given a first-degree murder conviction?
Well, that's a different issue completely.
It's separate.
Yeah, that's a wonderful rule that says we will always review these kinds of convictions. Right, but this is really an interesting old doctrine before we had victims' rights laws.
Yeah.
So the issues come up about what do you do about a restitution order to the victim?
So let me ask you about that because I was looking at a quote from back in 2013 from a lawyer who represents clergy sex abuse victims. And this was from Robert Sherman. And Robert Sherman said back then that I think the technical quirk in the law only serves to re-victimize the victims.
It may well, but the question is how you change, this is really settled precedent. This is, baked into the law. So there have been some changes that some higher courts have done, but ours have not. So this applies because it applies.
So now, Judge Gertner, if I may ask, since
yes,
you are retired and no longer actually on the bench.
You want me to rule?
There is, there may be legal tradition, but do you think it's still a good idea?
I'm not certain. I won't weigh in one way or the other. Certainly, there's a question of what to do about restitution to victims and whether that counts as part of the punishment. I'm not sure what the answer is here because the appeal is not nothing. In other words, if there were meaningful challenges to this conviction, the absence of the ability to test that does cast doubt on the underlying conviction. So the rule had a good purpose here. If you haven't tested the conviction, then it's not fair to have the consequences of the conviction. That's really where it comes to. So I'm not sure that I would throw it out. The implications for the pending civil cases are a different question.
Right. I was going to ask you about that because there are some regarding Aaron Hernandez. Does this affect those at all?
There are two issues that I'm at least aware of. One is the wrongful death action against Hernandez. And the absence of a conviction means that they would have to prove that he was responsible for the death of Odin Lloyd. That may not be difficult to do because in a civil case, the standard is a fair preponderance of the evidence, not beyond a reasonable doubt. So they could. It's what happened in the O.J. Simpson case. Yeah. He couldn't be convicted, but he certainly could wind up with a wrongful death challenge. So that proceeds. The questions that people have been raising about the Patriots' money that they owe Lloyd, that's an issue of contract. It depends on the language of the contract. I haven't the foggiest idea. I can make something up.
So for folks who don't know, this is the fact that the Patriots were citing Hernandez's convicted status as one of the reasons why they weren't paying his estate some $6 million.
Right.
I mean,
so that will depend on what the language of the contract is. Does it say convicted of? Does it say charged with? Does it say proof of? It depends on the language of the contract.
Contract law working its way into this. Judge Gertner, if I may say, this is the first time in many conversations with you that I've seen you be less than passionate about
certain, an outcome.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I mean, you are an unmitigated advocate for those legal decisions that you agree with. But this one, I am detecting some hesitation.
Well, I mean, actually, your question before, which I poo-pooed, is more significant, which is that the question of an automatic appeal in a murder case, it really means that the appellate rights are baked into the process. And if you can't have an opportunity to test your conviction, and there may be legitimate reasons to test it, then there shouldn't be a conviction. That's really, as I said a moment ago, that's really what this is about. Hmm. It's not a technicality that has no substance or no provenance in this world. It does matter. We don't consider a conviction final until the SJC rules that it's final.
So this may sound like a completely silly question, but alas, I did not do well in the LSAT. Why couldn't the test go forward without the defendant?
Why the appeal could go forward? There are some states in which the appeal could go forward, yes, but not Massachusetts. So that would be the kind of change that they could make here. There are some states that have a substitution of the estate. We usually don't do that in criminal cases because we usually believe that the defendant has to participate, the defendant has to be there. Civil cases are different. So that could be an adjustment that the SJC does, but as I said, it's not they are not likely to do it in a particular case because you don't change the rules midstream in a given case.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So maybe it wasn't such an ignorant question after
all.
It
was not. I will grant you the LSATs. Passing the LSATs.
Which I hear a lot of law schools don't even need you to take anymore.
There you go.
Okay. Well, let's move on to news at the federal judiciary level. That's President Donald Trump has announced 10 nominees to the federal bench. There are currently more than 120 court vacancies. Judge Gertner, I mean, we could go through the list of judges one by one. We don't have time for that, but let's just have it suffice to say that many of the judges came from a list or similar list to the ones that he had compiled for his Supreme Court picks. And that list was created by the Federal Society, the Heritage Foundation, you know, conservative groups that are looking for a particular kind of judge to put on the federal bench. So your response to that?
Well, I was troubled by the notion that there may be a slate for these vacancies. The Supreme Court is one thing, but the lower federal courts, the appellate courts and the district courts, I've never heard of a slate before. So the notion that some of these came from, that sort of a sine qua non of getting on this list was being approved by the Heritage Foundation or the Federalist Society, that really is a new development. Contrast, if you will, Senator Warren had a merit selection committee in Massachusetts to fill four vacancies after I left the bench. And we opened up the process to everybody. We had, you know, interviewed everybody and came up with a set of recommendations. We didn't require that everybody be approved by the ACLU or the American Constitution Society. So that's the troubling part here. It narrows the focus of who gets on the federal bench. It creates sort of a doctrinaire requirement for who gets on the federal bench. And while the process is political, there's no question about it. I think that this is skewing it further politically than they should.
Hmm. Well, if I have this right, it seems as if maybe two of the 10 judges that the president nominated were also nominated by Obama. So it'll be interesting to see if those judges now all of a sudden get through, because many of these positions were held open by the Senate because they just refused to have hearings on the nominees.
Right. I mean, I call this the Garland effect. I mean, it was not only Merrick Garland that was held up, but I saw a statistic that suggested that Obama had only gotten through 20 appointments in his last 2 years, whereas Bush, Reagan, and Clinton had gotten through many, many more. So the fact that there are these vacancies is a function of what the Senate did. Mm. And the two Obama appointees who were held up and now proposed by Trump, so there are two narratives there. One narrative is Obama was looking for moderates, that is to say people who could satisfy everyone, which is what he thought he was doing with Garland. And Trump is looking for people who are approved by the Heritage Foundation, the Federalist Society.
Well, there are, as we said, more than 120 court vacancies right now. And just FYI for listeners, by contrast, President Obama had 54 vacancies to fill when he came into office. So we'll continue to see who President Trump nominates to all these open seats on the federal court. In the last minute that we have, Judge Gertner, let me just ask you about a ruling last week that came out of the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court. It boils down to the fact that the SJC has ruled that law enforcement will have to seek a warrant in order to review text messages on the phone of a suspect. And beforehand, apparently in certain cases, the law enforcement officers said that or believed that they did not have to secure a warrant in this case. So what's your thought about this ruling?
This is actually continuing a longstanding distinction that the cases are making between content and the from and to indications on an email. So, for example, from and to, it has in some courts have said from and to in an email are not don't require a warrant, but the content of the message is a different issue. It's like I can look at the envelope of a letter, but in order to open it up and read its contents, I have to have a search warrant. So they're saying that the text message is the functional equivalent of opening up the letter and trying to respect those distinctions in the digital world that we have in the physical world.
Interesting ruling. Well, Nancy Gertner is a former federal judge here in Massachusetts. She's also WBUR's legal analyst and a professor at Harvard Law School. Judge Gertner, it's always great to have you. Thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.
Back in a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.